Everyone, welcome to Museum Theatre Musings, the podcast which assumes that you either know what museum theatre is or are extremely keen to find out. I am your host, Jo Klein, and I'm broadcasting from Melbourne, Australia. So if you are joining me from anywhere else in the world, I hope you enjoy listening to some seriously broad vowels. For this inaugural episode, I will assume that at least some of you may not know exactly what museum theatre is. It's a lovely little compound word comprised of two truly excellent things, museum and theatre. You will hear a few acronyms bandied around throughout this series, the most important being IMTAL, which stands for the International Museum Theatre Alliance. It's an organisation that was founded in 1990 in America as a professional interest group for museum theatre practitioners. It was followed by IMTAL Europe in 1999, and IMTAL Asia Pacific in 2008. In the very broadest sense, museum theatre is the interpretation of museum objects or themes conveyed through the genre of performance. But before people start firing off indignant emails, I would like to state that there are so many more nuances to it than that. But as we progress through each episode, we'll look at exactly what would fall under that general definition, and in some cases, perhaps try and isolate exactly what wouldn't qualify as museum theatre. So it would be very lonely to do all of that by myself, so I will be inviting some very special guests along to help me. My first guest is Peter Wilkins, director of the Come Alive Festival of Museum Theatre in Canberra, Australia. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Jo. Lovely to be here.
So Peter, I happened upon you at several conferences, both museum and museum education conferences, and you were presenting on the wonderful work that you were doing with high school students in museum theatre. So can you tell us a little bit about the Come Alive Festival of Museum Theatre, what it is and why it started?
Yeah, sure. The Come Alive Festival is a festival specifically for school-age students to participate in theatre productions that have been inspired by collections in museums. And it began with a conversation with Lynn Beasley. And Lynn was the manager of learning at the National Museum of Australia in 2010. And I had already done a couple of shows there. One of them was called Stranded, about the Vienna Mozart Boys Choir, who got stranded in Australia when war broke out. And it was their story of how they survived here and how they became really residents and citizens of Australia, many of them in Melbourne, of course, where you are. Mm. And I also said at that stage, because a couple of other schools had done something, Canberra Girls Grammar School, for example, and St. Clair's College. And I said, wouldn't it be terrific if we could actually get schools in the ACT to put together pieces that are inspired by the various collections, and at that time specifically the collection of the National Museum of Australia, and put it together as a festival, which we would do then if it was successful. So this was very much in 2010, a pilot festival. It worked extremely well. I've forgotten now, there are about 12 schools involved. And so we decided to continue that at the National Museum. So it really came about from a conversation, you know, casual conversation, but a desire by Lynn and myself to really encourage schools to make that leap from the classroom into the actual museums.
When I first saw sort of extracts from this piece, I was blown away by the quality of the performance. So the depth of the content, the sophistication of the topic, because it's a really powerful story with one such as Stranded, because it's about a group of children from Vienna who literally get stuck in Australia during the war, and many of them made lives for themselves here.
There's a lovely story that we took Stranded on tour, which is when I think you might have seen it, and we did the nursing homes in Melbourne. And we ended up at one of the far out nursing homes and did the show. And then afterwards we talked with the residents of the nursing home. And one of the ladies said, "Oh, Otto Nechvatal, he fixed my kettle for me." It was, you know, just that terrific connection. And most of them, as I said before, you know, made their homes in Melbourne, because the reason for that was that Archbishop Mannix rescued them. He basically said, "Look, if you become a choir at St. Patrick's Cathedral, then I'll find foster homes for you and you can stay here in Melbourne and be my church choir," which is what they did.
Now, Peter, I know that you do a lot of work in the theatrical world in Canberra, which is where you're based. So that's the national capital of Australia. So you write theatrical reviews for the newspapers and various critic bulletins. But I believe you came to museum theatre through your background in education. Is that right?
Yeah, I trained as a teacher, and specifically a drama teacher. And then I was in Europe and they asked me to come back to Australia to set up with some other people, obviously, the first secondary theatre and education team in Adelaide. And so, much to my wife's dismay, because she was loving her life in Spain at the time, I came back. As a result of that, she actually became head of art at the Australian War Memorial eventually. So, you know, it all turned out well for her too.
Family.
But, quite coincidental. And so I then went into the theatre and education game, and I left teaching. And I didn't return to teaching until, 17 years later or something, 15 years later, when I went to Narrabundah College after a very short stint at the National Library of Australia. And it was really at Narrabundah College that I became more involved in international theatre and international museum theatre as well.
Well, that leads on quite nicely to my next question, which is everyone's origin story. At what point you find yourself doing museum theatre and going, "Oh, that's actually what I'm doing. It's got a name. It's got sort of a some founding principles to it, and it has objectives in terms of form and function." So what's your origin story? How did you come to be developing from, you know, a teacher and working in theatre and education to actually going, "Well, I'm now doing museum theatre"?
Yeah, well, it all started in 1980. I'd been in Canberra directing Jigsaw Theatre Company in 79, and then went back to Adelaide, where they asked me to come and set up the secondary education team again with a different company, with a primary company. And I became the chair of the Association of Community Theatres. And we had a request from Peterborough in South Australia from a lady there who said, "I would like to really do something with youth around this whole area, Peterborough, Kapunda, et cetera, et cetera. And there's an old orphanage just outside Peterborough, St. Cecilia's." And we were thinking, wouldn't that be a great location to bring kids in to reenact stories of that environment and basically learn more about the history of their own places of, in South Australia. So I said, "Yeah, that sounds like a great idea." And we got together a small team to do choreography and music and all that kind of stuff, and theatre performances, and did this production where we used all the rooms of the orphanage and the kids basically did tableaus. It was a very, very simple thing. But then we had a musical director who worked with them on the song for the whole thing, and put together over the week that they were there, this event. And I had always had an interest in history, and I thought, you know, this is just terrific, doing live theatre in what was essentially a museum. It was a deserted orphanage, and this is something that we could continue. So with the team, I then worked with another member of that team and did a project with the Constitutional Museum in Adelaide. And that, again, was where we brought all these kids from around South Australia to Adelaide. And my colleague worked with teachers, college students, to put together a show called "Not Tonight, Josephine, I'm Planning a New Utopia," which was the story of Wakefield. And he worked with those aspiring actors and drama teachers on that piece, and I worked with all the kids from around surrounding South Australia on the actual debates in the late 19th century. And it was a remarkable time because, as you know, South Australia introduced the first suffrage for women. Plus, there was a whole question on water crisis at that time, which is still, you know, the whole Murray-Darling issue, etc. So that sort of entrenched me in museum theatre. And I thought, this is fabulous. This is such a fantastic way of, A, getting kids to do theatre, which was really my prime interest, and to learn about Australia in particular, because all of these projects were obviously located in institutions that dealt with Australian history. And so that's how it really began. That was the spark that set it off.
So that's really interesting because, you know, the first thing you mentioned was that you did a performance at an orphanage. So with museum theatre, we sometimes talk about, you know, it's not just museums, it's also heritage sites. It can be an aquarium, it can be a zoo, an abandoned factory. So it's really, even though the term is museum theatre, it does cover cultural institutions and then a bit further as well. So the way you sort of link to place is really, really important. And I can't imagine why. Well, it's a quite an evocative place, isn't it? You know, an orphanage, particularly for students to be performing in, children.
Well, you also have this image of ghosts, don't you? You know, wandering the rooms of the orphanage and all these mysterious stories. So
potentially quite evocative. A sad environment. So, you know, it certainly adds an undercurrent. In some ways, a traditional theatrical environment is supposed to be fairly neutral. It's a place where anything can come in and you can be transformed. But when you take it all out, it's supposed to be a neutral environment. Where with heritage sites or museums or something like an orphanage, it already has that layer. And it's not always set up for performance. So, you know, you talk about using the different rooms. You know, means the audience has to travel a bit. They have to be more awake. They can't be completely sucked in to the action. They have to be a little bit more participatory, I think.
That's right. It's a promenade piece where the audience has to be an active participant in the drama.
The other thing that really struck me and has with all of your performances is how hard-hitting they are. You don't go with simple themes. These are stories with incredible depth, and they, you know, a lot of them are very emotional. And I think for students, young people investigating these themes, it really provides a lot of opportunity for emotional maturity and engaging with hard histories. Can you tell us about some of the themes of the museum theatre performances that you've helped facilitate?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that hard-hitting emotional context makes me think of the production that Arana Steiner School here in Canberra did about the British kids who were brought out here as migrants after the war, and they ended up in orphanages. And Jane Watson, who was the teacher, a remarkable teacher with them, put together this show about their experiences in the orphanage, which was really absolutely horrific, absolutely horrific. And the play went for about an hour, and it was based on these tea jugs as such, which were, they were art pieces. And the show was called The Cardinal's Tea Set. And she had found, and the kids had found, all these rules of etiquette of the 19th century. So you had this rule of etiquette, refinement, genteel society, contrasting with the brutality of life in that orphanage. And it was incredibly emotional. But so many of those productions have been hard-hitting. Part of it for the senior students is that's who they are. Mm. You know, it's the angst, and it's the whole questioning of who am I, where am I, what am I going to become in my life? And these productions help them to distill that understanding of humanity, and also the understanding of themselves, and the understanding of how history forms the society and impacts upon society.
I really love that. Yeah.
Pardon?
I really love that because it's not a direct line. I mean, you have a tea set, you know, you can do a literal interpretation of it, But then you can really bring in those really good critical and creative thinking skills and go, how can we tease this out into a much more sophisticated performance? And also investigating different perspectives. What I really love about some of the shows we've done is how they look at modern versus historical perspectives. I think the one about the Miss Australia competition was particularly good. Could you tell us a little bit more about that one?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was fun. That was sheer fun. I mean, that was musical theatre. And it was associated with the exhibition that actually came up from Melbourne. I think it came up, if I remember, from the Ian Potter Gallery. And it then toured, and it coincided with the publication of the catalogue, which was actually published by the National Museum of Australia. So it must have been a National Museum of Australia project to look back at the Miss Australia quest. And of course, the controversy there is the exploitation of the female body, and that, and then this absolute contradiction you have of how much money it raised for what at that stage was called the Spastic Centre. You know, that's not a politically correct term now, but when doing museum theatre, we have to look at the history and the time and the context. And so we do use terms that now may no longer be applicable or have been changed in some way or other. But they raised millions, literally. And there were people that would look at that and say, well, you know, it's ladies in frocks looking glamorous. I mean, the whole notion of wealth and the fact that the society is so divided between those who have and those who have not. So from a political point of view, it was actually quite a hard-hitting musical. Mm. And as you remember, it was using the old favourite songs, the Fred Astaire stuff and the Frank Sinatra stuff and all of that. So it was very much of its time and of its period. But
and students were learning about that period. A lot of them wouldn't have known Frank Sinatra songs. So you've added a little bit to their musical education by them revisiting historical times where music was different, and that's something which will probably always resonate with them.
Absolutely, and I mean that's very interesting point, Joe. You make a very good point there, because with Stranded, for example, when I started, they weren't interested in it. They said, "Oh no, look, this is there's not much here." They'd rather do something that was modern and contemporary and TV based. I mean, not necessarily, but I'm using that as an example. And then I showed them Class of 39, which was an SBS doco that came out about the Vienna Mozart Boys Choir, but more from the perspective of what's happened to them since. So as adults, largely, like Otto Nechvatal. And they suddenly connected that these kids were really in a very, very difficult situation. It was based also on the exhibition of Leo Sayer, a very small exhibition in the museum, which included his passport, but also a letter from his mum written during the war while he was stranded in Australia, saying, "Leo, do not come home. It is horrible here," which of course it was. So a mother was telling her son not to come back, to stay away, and if necessary, make your life there, because Australia is the land of opportunity.
Which is something that people really find very hard to process, especially teenagers. But what you said is amazing. So you've gone from a group of disinterested teenagers to creating this incredibly successful production that's really had so much currency and has been performed in so many locations, and I'm sure will be a very memorable part of their teenage years, doing something that they invested so much in. But can you talk us a bit through the process? So obviously you have relationships with these, existing relationships with these schools. So they know about the Come Alive Festival of Museum Theatre. The school has done it in the past years. They have a bit of background history to it. But a new cohort arrives every year. And how do you start the ball rolling?
Well, Come Alive is different to stuff that I've done in the past, of course, because I work as the artistic director of the festival rather than as a teacher. I mean, I run workshops with all the schools and I go out and I see their work and all of that, and will help them, advise them, encourage them, whatever. But it's a different role that I'm performing. So I rely very much on the teachers. and the teachers have been fantastic, and they are the ones who are now coming back each year. So, for example, Joe Woodward, I've sent you that poster design that he put together, has been such a magnificent supporter. And each year he has a different cohort of kids, that's quite true. But he already has an understanding and a knowledge of how museum theatre works and how to structure it, from the discussions to the improvisations to the scripting to the rehearsing, then to the final performance.
In education, we have a concept called scaffolding, where it's not that you just dump students into, you have to create something. And what you talked about showing that documentary to them is part of scaffolding. So you have to, help them learn about the content, provide them an, I suppose, justification as to why it's important, why they should engage with something, and sort of leave a trail of breadcrumbs almost of all the things that they could draw together or seize on, and that's how they sort of craft a piece of performance. What I was really interested in, obviously I was so fascinated with this process. I came to visit you, I think it was 2013, when you just started with a group, and I followed the students around the exhibition because you just let them loose in the gallery in the National Museum of Australia and said, go and find some things you're interested in. And watching them was just so intriguing because of what they were interested in and what they weren't interested in. So what has surprised you in terms of topics they've chosen that you think they wouldn't have considered?
Well, I suppose what surprises me most are those topics that I know least about. Because I would assume on a lot of those that I do know quite well, let's say the Lindy Chamberlain case, the Harold Holt drowning, the obviously the stranded situation, those are topics that A, they may know something about, e.g. Harold Holt, very, very briefly. I mean, it was 1967 or whatever it was, very briefly, but they may have some knowledge. It's those where they have absolutely no knowledge. And I was fascinated last year when Warehouse Circus came into the festival for the first time. They had real trouble finding something, and the range of ages of kids went from, year five up to one of them was secondary college. So it was a large cohort, well, age-wise. And they found, I know I found, that's right, because he was having real problems. A lovely guy who directs them. And it was 3, 4 weeks before the festival went on, that he suddenly came up and said, oh, I still haven't got anything. And I thought, oh God, what's this going to be like? And, so I did a bit of research and I came across, because I wanted it to be circus based, I came across Mae Worth. I don't know if you know
Yes,
Mae
I do
Worth.
know my worth, yes.
Yeah. And I didn't. I knew the Worth Circus, but I don't think I knew about Mae Worth whatsoever. And I was surprised that the kids didn't know Mae Worth either. But I was surprised by how enthusiastic they became when they found out about this bareback rider who, while two horses were running around the ring, would somersault from one horse to the other horse, and then became obviously a performer with Barnum and Bailey, etc., and became internationally renowned.
The
So a
children's
slap on
feature
my.
book about her. So I think that's where she's got a little bit more publicity recently, was this children's book about her.
Yeah, and also I went to Adelaide, to the Adelaide Fringe, and I saw the this women's singing group. I've forgotten their name. Seven, no, not Seven Sisters. But anyway, they performed at the Fringe in the Mae Worth tent,
Wow.
and then they've had a circus festival here in Canberra, which finished about a month ago, and their main event was in the Mae Worth tent. It's a tent which tours from Melbourne, obviously where it's based, through to various cities, a bit like the Spiegel tent. But I've been surprised by the fact that the topics are so diverse, I think. I keep thinking Ulladulla High School did something about boats, and I knew nothing about it, and I'm surprised that the kids found out about it. And most of these kids obviously the teacher has exposed them to opportunities, either by going to Trove or to the website or going into the museum and the gallery. But the choices are really left field in many, many cases that you wouldn't expect. When I did it at the National Museum, we focused on the Eternity Gallery, which had the stories of Jenny Key, the stories of Ben, what's his name, the singer, Ben Lee, and that. So it was fairly obvious.
It had popular things like the Wiggles. So really Eternity feature stories. So in some ways you could kind of expect that students would choose something that's already been packaged for them.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't always, did they?
No, oh no, not they more or less did during that time because, as you say, it was packaged for them and presented to them. It was really the best of the least. But when the Eternity Gallery went, and when we moved, for example, to Questacon, then to the Museum of Australian Democracy, the National Library, the National Gallery, etc., when we started travelling to different institutions, that's when it really opened the slather for them. And they had a huge choice. And this portrait gallery, it was really interesting what they chose there. And that poster that I've sent you for this year's festival, with the dancer, Ashley Nguyen, in it, that whole dance piece was about identity. So she took the mask that's in the portrait gallery, which is the Asian mask, and then from that asked, who am I? And that dance piece included moments of classical, contemporary dance, and also what I would call probably identity moments within it. So, no, I'm absolutely fascinated each year, Joe, by what they come up with.
I do like it when they choose something that they can't identify. I think one year they did, I saw them, well, first following them around the gallery, they were looking at Shackleton's story. I was like, well, that's, you know, very far removed from anything that they've ever experienced.
Sorry, which story?
Shackleton.
Oh, yeah, Shackleton, right.
And
I mean, the other classic example, I suppose, of something they knew nothing about is when they looked at James Tyrrell. Darren Marlan College did that show in the National Gallery when we were working with the National Gallery on James Tyrrell and the whole notion of light and that. And that is something which none of them would have had any clue about.
Which
He's not
I
very
really
well
love.
Known.
Because I just think that museum theatre is such an appropriate vehicle for introducing new knowledge. But the great thing here is you've got this learning experience for the audience, but so much for the students to embody that depth of knowledge and then perform it, you know, is a really extraordinary learning experience.
Yeah, very true. And I'm always interested in finding out what you don't know about. It's the whole notion of curiosity, which is, for me, is at the very heart of art, any art. You have to start from that point of view. And an audience may come in. Now, for example, the audience will come into a Lindy Chamberlain thing. Now, Lindy Chamberlain is pretty well known by most audiences, given that most
in
of those...
Australia. So obviously, if you're listening from a different country, museum theatre has a following in many, many countries. The Lindy Chamberlain story, it did certainly make international news in the 80s, but it was about the family baby potentially being kidnapped by a dingo, not kidnapped, taken by a dingo. Dingo obviously cannot kidnap anyone, but taken by a dingo, and it became a, you know, a huge case where the Chamberlain family were potentially blamed for harming.
That's right.
Oh, it became a film. It became the subject of a lot of documentaries.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But what they didn't know, and even I don't think the film even really covers it, is the irony of the entire piece through the court proceedings. And that's what the kids brought out in a very simple piece. It was only about 15 minutes long, 20 minutes maybe. Somehow they highlighted the irony of what I consider to have been stupidity in not really examining that evidence correctly. And of course, it brings up that whole debate of was she guilty, was she not guilty? And we know that, but I don't remember the details anymore, but I remember being struck by the fact that these kids, by looking at the court proceeding, looking at the transcript, then began to identify, hang on, something's not quite right here.
That's right. And they weren't alive when this all broke. So for them, it's like a
Oh,
cop
no.
revisiting something that they don't have a living memory but being in the
That's
museum.
right.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, the case with many of these pieces, that they don't have that living memory.
Peter, we've just come to a natural lull in the conversations, which means I'm just going to open up to my feature section where visitors to the podcast tell me their definition of museum theatre so I can note it down in my imaginary tome. So, can you please tell me what museum theatre is to you?
What a big question, Joe. What a
This
big question.
giant, giant
It's
question.
giant. Well, let's say what it's not to begin with, because museum theatre, very often, if you speak to somebody who's not engaged in museum theatre in some way or another, will see it as traditional theatre, which imitates the style and approach of the theatre of its time. And which is a sad thing to say. I went to see The Mousetrap the other night and reviewed The Mousetrap, which was exquisitely directed by Robin Nevin, exquisitely performed by every single actor on that stage, a set design to blow your mind, all within 1952 context. Everything about it was 1952. I was actually in London in 1960 and walked past the Mousetrap, never went to see it, unfortunately. But too many people think that's what it is. It's outdated, it's conventional, it's boring. My view of museum theatre was always, right from the very start, that it was a way of bridging the gap between the school and the cultural institution. So for me, it's theatre inspired by the collections of cultural institutions. And those cultural institutions aren't necessarily museums and galleries, as you already pointed out earlier, that they can be factories, they can be, well, the orphanage at Peterborough, you know, whatever. They can be a shop on the main street of a town which has been there for a long time. And I'm thinking in Queanbeyan, there was a thing called the School of Arts Cafe, for example. Well, that was a museum too, where some of the leading performers, particularly cabaret performers around Australia, performed in this very small place that served you a dinner, etc. Since gone, sadly. But my work effectively is to connect museums, cultural institutions with schools and the work that is being done by students in the performing arts, also, of course, in the visual arts, the literary arts, and also in history subject, conventional subjects, because museum theatre covers pretty well every aspect of the curriculum. You know, we've held it at Questacon, which you know only too well. We've held it at the Museum of Australian Democracy. We've held it at the gallery. We've held it in various places. And I've also done work. Currently, I've been commissioned to write a play on the paddle steamer Enterprise. So you could almost say it also includes the water as a museum. And that will go on at the National Museum at some stage or other. So I don't know if that gives some clarity to definition,
I
Joe,
love
but
it. That's probably
that's
an
how I
easier
view
way
it.
explaining what museum theatre is not, because often we wrestle to kind of summarise all the things that potentially could be. But it is different. But what did really strike me with many of the students who participated in the Come Alive Festival was how good their training in drama already was. So even though they were bringing the conventions of museum theatre, they already knew about performance. They knew how to build a character. They knew how to create visual shortcuts to stage something. And the way they kind of bogged in, also the improvisation skills seemed really good too. And I know it's because they have really fantastic drama departments at these schools that they were able to already bring in that knowledge. and those really good practices, and then work with the museum to create something that was just a really high quality. And that really did impress me.
Yeah, I think we have to remember too that in terms of the museum theatre in Come Alive, it's all original work based on known stories. So, I mean, Jane Watson made a point that, it's play building, obviously, but it's play building where they have the information to structure, to scaffold, if you like, the drama through the old whiteboard method, the butcher's paper method, the improvisation method, the playing and experimenting and exploring method. So it is very much a constructed view of their approach to that particular stimulus.
The other thing I wanted to mention was everyone thinks that museum theatre is about lighthearted, fluffy topics that can't upset people. So things like dinosaurs or geodes, but the reality is you can tackle some very difficult questions and some challenging topics and really divided opinions, and also when terrible things happen. And one of the topics I'm referencing is when the National Museum of Australia was built, there was an accident, and one of your groups of students explored the idea of creating a piece of museum theatre performance about the actual building of the museum. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, no, that was Darramallen College last year that decided that they wanted to do a piece on the implosion. Many people may not be aware of that, but the government at the time, under the Chief Minister Kay Carnell, decided to remove the hospital, the Canberra Hospital, where my daughter was born, and build the new National Museum of Australia on that site across the lake. And she decided that she would make this a big public event. So she invited everybody to come and stand on the banks across the lake from the hospital and view the implosion when the whole building would collapse. And there was a whole stuff up, basically, that the wrong explosives were used, the wrong amount of explosives were used. And what happened? The thing just exploded rather than imploded, and fragments went flying across the lake, narrowly missing people who actually were on boats on part of the lake, except for one piece that went across the lake straight into a 12-year-old schoolgirl standing on the banks to watch this remarkable spectacle, and it killed her. And Katie Bender's memorial is there, and I sort of, I choke up when I think of it, Joe. Is there for everyone to see not only what a tragedy this was, but how it impacted on the innocence of that particular family. Now, me choking up might suggest also that it would be a choke up for the performers. They were certainly moved by it. They were certainly amazed by it. But they decided that they would make it a movement piece rather than dramatic scenes. Because really, once you go into that dramatic scene without finding a style that really makes an audience think and makes an audience appreciate, you begin to trivialize. And there's too much theatre for me dealing with very, very serious themes that quite innocently and quite inadvertently will trivialise that. They didn't. They created, and what they did then was that they had the voiceovers of the actual people involved in the thing. So it had that truthful reality to it, obviously. But it also, because it's disengaged, it made audiences think of what this really meant rather than just hearing it verbatim and taking it for granted. And one of the students composed the score for the piece too, so that resonated hugely with them. It was a very, very moving piece, very powerful piece, not very long. I think it was only about 8 minutes long, but it said as much as a 1 hour scripted drama might say.
Those are very clever choices, because often we say in drama, don't tell us, show us. So rather than just recapping what happened and showing a chronological, retelling of the incident. This is a deeper form of interpretation.
Yeah, I have a dilemma sometimes, because I say to them always, you must be true to the situation. In other words, the facts have to be true. And we had a situation years and years ago where, interestingly enough, it was a college that I knew very, very well, that went to the Eternity Gallery, and they took the section on chance. And chance is the story of Jenny Key in the Granville train disaster, where she nearly died, obviously, and then became this amazing fashion designer with a zest for life and for colour and for vivacity. And these kids looked at chance. They just looked at the title, and they put together this piece about some girl who got on a plane and it crashed so that her dreams were totally and utterly destroyed. And I had to say to them, look, I'm sorry, you can't perform this, because the aim of museum theatre is to inform, enlighten people about the collections in the museums. So it really had to focus.
It's just not taking a topic. It's really, I suppose that is the difference between museum theatre. It's rooted in truth. And the idea is to communicate things that actually happened.
Exactly. And the style can be very different. You know, you can do it in an operatic style, a dance style, a melodrama style, whatever. You can choose your style appropriate to the theme and appropriate to the context, but you don't distort the facts. We're not into fake news.
No, and that's, you know, it's hard, because some galleries, they use artistic interpretations of things. You have to be very clear about what is interpretation or display of something in a creative manner, where the truth and the history and the science lies. Because, of course, museum theatre doesn't just interpret history. It also interprets things like technology and science. So henceforth, you had the one at Questacon. Just on a final note, so the Come Alive Festival of Museum Theatre has been very successful. So it hasn't just produced quality museum theatre. It's really promoted the genre. It's provided some really good, I think, blueprints for how you go about creating successful things with students. And it's a concept I hope would be taken up in other countries as well. So if you were giving advice to somebody in another country who wanted to create something similar, what would you say to them?
I think the ingredients of success are really, really clear, Jo, in creating a festival, a museum theatre. And in my case, if there hadn't been someone like Lynn Beasley, for example, resident in an education position within the museum, doesn't have to be education, it could be curatorial, for example, but someone within the museum with a passion for bringing to life the collection, then it won't work. I ran a workshop years ago for, they were called the outreach people of museums in Adelaide, the Migration Museum, the Art Gallery, the museum itself. And nothing has ever come of that. You know, and I think Michael Mills, for example, I'm sure also has had to struggle in many ways too with inspiring the actual people within the museum. He may have had more luck because he's based in Adelaide, you know. I'm a foreigner.
Just for everybody who doesn't know who Michael Mills is, he's another museum theatre practitioner who will be a subsequent guest on this podcast, but runs a production company called Heaps Good Productions. So
yeah, terrific. Terrific. So you need that. You need a teacher in a school who has a passion for museum theatre, understands what its aims are. Now, obviously, you know, after 13 years of doing a Come Alive Festival, I know there are a lot of teachers out there who are inspired, but it needs someone who is outside the school as well, well, to work as an artistic director.
We have three champions. We have a champion in the museum, a champion at a school, and then we have a champion in the style of Peter Wilkins type person, so an artistic director. So I'm seeing this triangulation in order to create a successful program.
I'll be quite honest about it now. It's becoming a real struggle because the institutions are not supporting it in the way that they've been able to do in the past. Now, COVID had a huge effect financially. So that this year, for example, I've had to rely on Joe Woodward at Darren Marlin College to support a poster because the Portrait Gallery said they couldn't do it this year. They can do the participation certificates. The National Library is very happy for the kids to come in, and they will really help, both institutions will really help students to find the particular topics that they want to work with. And they may help with the printing of the programs, but it really is a case now where it almost has to be self-sustaining. There's no grant, there's no public funding, there's no education funding for it.
Very wealthy in Australia who would like to support the Come Alive Festival of Museum Theatre, you can call Peter Wilkins and offer some financial support.
The thing I do want to say on that, though, is that I have tried year after year to get people in other states to pick it up. So those three champions that you mentioned are three champions that I would really like to see in Australia somewhere.
As you know, as this is an international podcast, it's really great that you're able to share that all these pieces of gold to, you know, potentially inspire people, because you never know when someone will listen to something and just pick up an idea and run with it.
Peter, but I've had just on that. Sorry, can I interrupt? Sorry for interrupting, but just on
I'm
that.
I'm trying to wind you up, but yes, please, please.
Yeah.
We could talk hours.
Sylvia from Greece has contacted me, and Melissa, who's at the National, at the Australian Museum, has contacted me. But Sylvia from Greece contacted me, and I think she's going ahead developing some kind of a festival in Athens.
Which is fantastic, because for such a sort of niche industry, there's those really great connections between IMTAL Americas, IMTAL Europe, and IMTALAP, which is IMTAL Asia Pacific. So as technology, communication technology improves, and WhatsApp groups and Facebook Messenger improve, we're definitely able to bounce things off each other much more successfully.
Well, people can contact me anytime, Joe.
Peter, thank you so much. What you've done is really created a very special type of museum theatre in Australia. And it's been certainly a joy, just from a very slight outsider perspective, to occasionally get to see what it is you do and wonderful benefits it has for students participating. So thank you for your work, and thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you for everything you do and for keeping museum theatre alive.
The theme music for this episode is the title song from These Curious Things, a piece of museum theatre written by Michael Mills of Heaps Good Productions in Adelaide, Australia, and performed by Gemma Dandy and Michael Mills.